Frank here. He's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard? Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, everybody.
What?
Come on. We call it the place to be.
The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can...
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied, smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be a Nation, welcome to another exciting episode of the Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and tonight we'll be delving back into the Vintage Vault for another one of our classic WWF pay-per-view reviews. And with me, as always, is the man who routinely has the mega powers exploding in his pants, and that is my PIC, Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
And I was about to say, we had such a great dramatic open with a big overture. And
I realized I didn't have my open thought of until about 30 seconds into that one. I'm like, well, I was trying to get something to go with the song, and it wasn't really working, so I just...
How are you tonight, sir?
Not too bad.
We got a good one. We got a good one tonight. We got a good one. Kind of fitting for this week. Kind of yes. Fitting for this week as we open the vault up. Keys are have them right here. The door's already open. There's the file. Tonight, on the Place to Be podcast, and actually, it's funny because we had one of our loyal fans a little nervous this week because we usually average about two podcasts a week. But this week, of course, obviously being the unfortunate passing of Macho Man Randy Savage on Friday, we did a special extra podcast on Monday. And then, of course, last night, you and I threw books at each other during our excellent social networking / office special with Leanne and Josh. So people were thinking, oh, no, they're not going to get their vault this week. Of course, we never let anybody down.
No, we bring the heat.
We bring the heat. We rock it. So tonight, we open the vault for, and again, very ironic, after the passing of one of the greatest of all time, one of his crowning moments in the ring, even though he didn't win, and that is, of course, tonight on the Vintage Vault, WrestleMania 5.
The Mega Power! Explode! Here at WrestleMania 5!
And there you go. Of course, is the open with the wonderful tones of Vince McMahon bringing us in inside the Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City. The attendance on that night, April 2nd, 1989, was 18,946. Now, Scott, we had the numbers pulled up. Now, I believe that was how many more than WrestleMania 4? About 800, correct?
It was about 800, yeah. WrestleMania 4, I think, was 18,160-something, 165.
So, looks like they handed out maybe a few more comps this year and got some more guys in there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there were some extra high rollers in the casino picking some extra tickets. So yeah.
And closed circuit attendance, 175,000, buy rate 5.9, and as always, in the WrestleMania commentary booth was Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura.
Yes, and 5.9, still, again, pretty solid. Again, we don't, obviously more, clearly more, buy rates or more, obviously, viewers, but again, this was the absolute last one. This was the last time that WWF and the NWA would try and butt heads.
Right.
Just like the previous January of 1988 when the NWA was countered with their pay-per-view by Vince doing the free Royal Rumble.
Mm-hmm.
This night, WrestleMania 5, the NWA decided to do their, I think it was their sixth ever free Clash of the Champions.
Right. Well, the first one was the year before, the night of WrestleMania 4.
That's right. So this is the second straight year at WrestleMania that the NWA threw a free show. Now, the main event of that show was that awesome 45-minute draw between the NWA World Heavyweight Champion Ric Flair and Sting, pretty much Sting's coming out party. This year, probably one of my five or six favorite matches of all time. and that is the 2 out of 3 falls match at the Superdome in New Orleans between the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, ironically, and Ric Flair, 2 out of 3 falls, which was won controversially by Ricky, 2 falls to 1. And then, of course, Flair would win the belt back at that awesome, one many considered the great, one of the greatest matches ever. I always kind of like the 2 out of 3 a little bit better myself, but the Wrestle War match in Memphis, or was it Nashville? Nashville, I believe, where Flair won the belt back. But
yes.
So on this same night, and this was it. They didn't do it again. They didn't do it again. The cable companies, and they just said, enough's enough. You guys can
right.
share,
yeah, exactly.
pick your own dates and move on. It was just getting tedious after a while.
So, and of course, this also, while not being one of the greatest venues, very unique venue, but it was fitting. I was glad they did the back-to-back in the same venue just because of how symmetrical the story is.
Right.
Beginning at WrestleMania 4, ending at WrestleMania 5. It made sense to have it in the same location where the Mega Powers were born and where they eventually explode.
Exactly. And this, a lot of people think, now let's look, just to clarify, in terms of WrestleMania, yes, this is the only time in WrestleMania history where the venue would be repeated in the following year. It would never happen again. This is not the first time, though, that it has happened, period. Of course, the 87 and 88 mm-hmm. Survivor Series, the 88 and 87 and 88 Survivor Series were both at,
Richfield Coliseum.
Yeah. And then SummerSlam 2010. Last year's SummerSlam for the second straight year would be at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. So it's not unique,
right.
but obviously WrestleMania is different than the other pay-per-view brands.
Mm-hmm.
And it would never, I don't know if will it ever happen again? Probably not. But this is the only time it happened in the history of WrestleMania. And Gorilla and Jesse are in the booth. And
yes.
And, as expected, they usually carry a lot of the fluff here.
Oh yeah. They're great here as always. And actually
yeah.
I think with each WrestleMania, they've improved upon the year before. And I think 6 ends up being their best performance, but 5 improves upon their performance at 4. Because Jesse just got angrier as the years went on.
Yeah, that's true. He found more guys to hate. Usually his vitriol was strictly at Hogan, but over the next year, he finds some more guys to despise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we usually go back and forth. Would you like me to do the odds? Because your favorite tag team of all time is at number 2.
Yes, let's go with that then.
All right, we'll do that then. All right, so
and,
the opener...
Yep, and with the opener, you can also kind of skip all the fun facts, because I think we've already talked about both of those things.
Exactly, yes. The opener is Hercules, now babyface, taking on King Haku, who officially kept his King crown with his win over Harley Race at the Royal Rumble, which we talked about in our last vault. He is officially the king now, no doubt about it. We talked about the whole backstory about how Bobby was selling Herc to DiBiase to be a slave, and Herc got pissed off and all this other stuff. And now Herc is taking on, really at the time, Bobby's top singles guy. Of course, that would well.
Yeah,
I was gonna
say, not quite.
Well, at the moment, it would obviously change later on in the show. But, you know, this is the only guy that technically has a title.
Yes.
And that's the king. That, of course, as I said, that changes later on in the evening. The match itself is, it's okay. It's nice for Herc to get his big moment in the sun, but it's nothing earth-shattering. And, you know, it was pretty straightforward. Haku can carry anybody, so it makes the match good.
Yeah, but I always liked this opener. I thought they worked well together. Hercules was still pretty over as a face here. You know, Haku obviously could always work. And the finish is a little confusing with that bridge suplex. Basically a repeat, like we said, of WrestleMania 4. Only this time Hercules gets a shoulder up and Haku doesn't, so he learns something from the year before, he wins a match, and this kind of wraps up the whole Hercules-Heenan feud, and then from here on out, Hercules just kind of meanders around the mid-card, but this was kind of the capper of his feud with Heenan, since he was still pissed that he had been sold to DiBiase, and you could kind of see here that the idea of turning Hercules' face maybe didn't take off the way they thought he was going to. It was kind of an ally to Hogan. He's kind of faded now into the mid-card.
Yeah, the problem is there's so many other faces pushing up the card that are just making a bigger impact that it was kind of hard to fit them somewhere. But, you know, Herc was still a favorite for a while, and, you know, that would change over the next year and a half and go back to being a heel, but we'll get to that when we get there. So Hercules wins the opener, bridge suplex, just under 7 minutes. And again, a pretty average match, nothing fancy. But, you know, Haku is solid. He could work with anybody, and Herc was probably letting him be a little stiff because, you know, Haku works that way, and Herc's a big, tough guy, so... probably helped the quality of the match a little bit. But good opener, nothing fancy. Crowd was into it, but you know, Bobby was the top manager of heels in the company, so he brings any kind of heat. So Yeah, no, nothing fancy. There'll be better openers in the future, but Haku brings a good match, and Hurt gets probably his biggest win of his career, you know, on a big stage. So
yeah,
there's your opener. Hercules gets the big win.
And from there, we get to, and really the first match that shows the real depth, again, of the tag division at this show.
Yep.
This was really the only WrestleMania that features this many tag matches, all with pretty much legitimate teams. In the hunt for the titles, and I really loved that aspect of the show. As long as and bloated as it is, I like that, how there's a lot of tag matches kind of breaking the card up. And of course, this match pits the Rockers, who made their debut at Survivor Series, against the Twin Towers, who also debuted as a team then, Akeem, the former one-man gang, and the Big Boss Man. At this point, though, really in a groove as a team, with Slick, and they really kind of had their shtick going, and you know, Akeem would do the dancing, and Boss Man was drilling people the nightstick and dropping the ball and chain on them. And I really love the dichotomy of this match, where you have the two small, fast, double teaming guys against the two like monster powerhouses. This is like a dream match for me, the way they put this thing together. And they really work it that way too. The Rockers keep, you know, ducking and moving and you know, hitting double drop kicks and clotheslines are flying all over the place, and the Twin Towers just at, you know, certain points of the match were just plant them with a clothesline or a splash in the corner or something to turn the tide. And I just liked how they constantly just, you know, regain control using their brute strength.
Yeah, you know, I just kind of realized as I'm looking at thinking about this match, the Twin Towers were almost the 80s version of the Big Show and Kane.
Yes.
You know, these two big dudes, fan favorites, just love getting, well, they weren't fan favorites, they were heels, but, you know, guys, fans like you who kind of had a soft spot for them. And they really had great chemistry. And this is one of those matches, and when Justin and I started writing these reviews when we first met shortly in 2003, a lot of these shows we watched one through, and then when we really took our reviews seriously, we went through them again. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first watched, obviously the first time I watched this match was the day it aired. I remember watching this Mania live. I thought, it's okay. I thought it was kind of plodding, and you know, the Rockers kind of got slowed down. And it never took me a while to really turn around to this match until we watched this again in, probably 2005 or 2006. I remember watching it again. And I realized, you know, the dichotomy is good. You know, you watch it really closely. Sean and Marty really do a good job getting the crap kicked out of them. You know, Sean's selling would serve him well for the rest of his career.
And you know what else I really like, too? Something that the commentary team wasn't totally known for. They were known for selling storylines and angles and characters, but they weren't really known for selling a story like in psychology of the match, Jesse and Gorilla. They did that here. I thought they really did a good job telling the story of the psychology behind how the Rockers and Twin Towers are going to work this match.
Yeah, because a lot of times the storyline itself was so juicy that the two of them had to snipe at each other about it. You really didn't have that here. They needed something to, and you know, Jesse really, definitely this last year plus that he's with the company, Jesse seemed to really try hard to really put over work rate in matches.
Yeah.
Besides just being a jerk, which he only is for certain guys. A lot of times he's pretty, I don't say down the middle, but he's usually focusing on the work rate and the quality of the match itself.
Mm-hmm.
And unless it involves Hogan or, you know, Warrior or something like that, when he really can't stand somebody and tries to really get the heel over. He really does a good job of that. And Gorilla, I have to say that was usually one of Gorilla's weaknesses. As much as Gorilla knew his game, I mean, there's no doubt about it, he knew the game. Trying to kind of pontificate that was kind of a struggle for him. His job was being the straight guy, putting over the baby faces, and that was it. And was he good at it? Absolutely. But these kind of matches, Jesse really was the one dictating the commentating, because he was good at doing that. Gorilla wasn't bad at it, but he needed Jesse to kind of weed him along a little bit. These matches that didn't have a lot of backstory to them, and you were talking about the match itself. And this is a perfect example of it. And this is a match that I started to like as I watched it a couple more times. Because I agree with you, the chemistry between this big team and this little team is really great. And, you know, you and I have both marks for big dudes
and big there are four early great, tag teams. There are four great spots that stand out in my mind in this match. That tells you how many times I've seen it. I had the commentary pretty much memorized at one point. I love the double drop kick the Rockers hit on the Big Boss Man. He does that, like, crazy running front bump that Boss Man was known for.
Yes.
Especially when he was bigger at this point. It looked even better. There's also a sick powerbomb that Boss Man gives Sean. At one point, really just totally rattles him. And then at the end, Akeem crushes Michaels with a clothesline and then a big splash for the win. So those four spots always kind of stood out in my mind. This has always been one of my favorite kind of underrated WrestleMania matches. And, you know, Shawn, obviously, what he becomes, WrestleMania legend, this is his first match, and it's a pretty good one. I mean, it kind of sets the stage for the run that he'll have, and a run that really will only, you know, include what, maybe two subpar, not even WrestleMania matches. You know, probably the one the next year is really the worst of the bunch. So,
right.
I really like this match. It was good for the Twin Towers. They get the win, kind of keep them strong. Because Boss Man was still feuding with Hogan at this point on the house show circuit. They were still working matches and stuff right. like that. So they wanted to keep them strong. So good match here. Very good match, I thought, to keep this card kind of rolling along.
Yes, I agree. And Twin Towers really, you know, showed their stuff. And I actually was kind of, you know, Slick was put together a pretty impressive stable at this point. Mm-hmm. You had the two of them and, you know, he would start to pick up, I know he would pick up a couple, someone else later on down, name's escaping me. But he would kind of build his stable a little bit as time would progress throughout the year. But, you know, these two guys are pretty solid. I mean, I'm trying to remember if there was ever, this would have been a good time, this 2 or 3 month kind of buffer. Maybe we have to look at the house shows, but I wonder if Demolition and the Twin Towers actually had legit, you know, tag title matches on the,
I think they probably did a little bit because they were against each other at SummerSlam in that six right. man. So you got to figure they were probably feuding on the house show circuit at that point for them to set that up.
Exactly. So
I can check that while we go along.
Yeah, because obviously we know who they end up feuding with in the summertime and what happens with the titles, but we'll get into that later. But you would think that the Twin Towers, who obviously were thought very highly winning this match on a big show, and the tag team champions being babyfaces, would have been a good combination to put together. But Justin will investigate that, of course, looking on the
Austin. July 9th, they, on a episode of Superstars, Demolition cut promos on the Twin Towers. So I'm okay. guessing that was probably setting up a
SummerSlam
house show. Well, yeah. And oh, yeah. House show.
Yeah. Now, had they lost yet the straps at that point? No, right?
July.
No, because the match, the Brainbusters match with the Heart Foundation had already been booked by that point. But we'll get into that at SummerSlam.
it looks like they were feuding. Looks like they started working the house shows in the summer.
Okay. They deserved it. Right, Twin Towers probably were the, I don't say they were the top heel team, but they were definitely climbing the ladder, and they showed it here with a big win over the Rockers. Our next match, a bet match that had been building for a while, and that was the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, taking on the Barber, Brutus Beefcake, and a big moment.
Actually,
in
I'm sorry, it was April Demolition, and the Towers started feuding.
Oh, okay. So it was shortly after this show. Which makes sense. So the timeline actually fits.
Yeah, it looks like they kind of fought each other throughout the spring and summer on house shows. And then,
yeah. So. Yeah. No, it okay. makes total sense. So our next match, again, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, taking on Brutus the Barber Beefcake. Obviously, Brutus, big time over face, and DiBiase, one of the top heels in all of wrestling. But a big moment or a big debut in this match. No, it's not a person. It's a thing. But it's a thing that ends up being a big piece of DiBiase's character and one of the most beautiful objects in the history of the World Wrestling Federation, if not the history of wrestling. And that is the debut of the Million Dollar Belt, resplendent with thousands and thousands of diamonds and shaped in the $3 signs. And for all of you young wrestling fans who thought that belt was fake, no. In a 2004 interview, DiBiase said the belt cost $25,000. So no, it was not one of Reggie Park's replicas you could buy for $250. No, Reggie Parks made that belt. For those who don't know, Reggie Parks is one of the preeminent belt makers in the wrestling business. Everybody goes to him for belts, and he made that belt. And I've actually held a replica. There was a guy, a person that used to work with us who brought it into work one day, and I actually held it. It's pretty damn heavy, let me tell you. Obviously, it's a replica, so it's not actual gold and diamonds, but if it is made to close to the actual weight, it is a pretty heavy belt.
Yes.
Because obviously, it's not leather. It's all metal.
Right.
So there's no, you know, it's not leather with. So it makes its debut here, and you know, obviously, DiBiase spent the whole year, you know, trying to wrangle the world title from Savage and Hogan, respectively, or Hogan and then Savage, respectively. Obviously couldn't get the job done, so to hell with it. I'm rich. I'm going to make my own belt.
And on the first match he debuted after was on the March 11th Saturday Night's Main Event. He defeated the Blue Blazer, and then after the match introduced the belt. Of course, there were vignettes leading up to that showing him shopping for it, and you get the classic one of him and that awesome cape going to the jewelers to have the belt commissioned.
That's one of the
vintage DiBiase moments. Someone actually has that as their avatar on the board. I forget who, but
they have the
picture of him walking in with the cape and laughing. So,
yes, he should have kept the cape.
Yeah, the cape was awesome.
And actually, also in this interview that DiBiase had in 2004, he had to carry the belt around in a gold Halliburton.
Hey, baby.
And he actually one time lost the belt at the Atlanta airport. I'm sure he went and could look for it because Vince would not have been pleased if he lost a $25,000 belt and some little hayseed kid picked it up in the luggage pickup at the Atlanta airport, which is a very large airport. So, and this is one of those cases. Now, the year before, DiBiase had a good run in the world title tournament at WrestleMania 4, and obviously ended with him losing the championship match to Randy Savage. That was a very good match. His match at SummerSlam, the tag, the Mega Bucks, mm-hmm. Mega Powers, very good match. Survivor Series, we don't really count because there's so many guys in it, and obviously the Rumble doesn't count either. But starting here, DiBiase goes through like a 3-year stretch where, probably 4 years if you count 92, where just WrestleMania, the storylines were always really juicy. Yes. I don't really remember this one that well.
I don't think there was too much here. Honestly, yeah. I don't remember it, but I'm guessing it seems like there was kind of two guys programmed with each other just to have a match.
Exactly. And but the match just didn't deliver. Ends in a double countout. We all know how much we hate those. It was almost 10 minutes, which probably didn't need to be that long. I would have put more. I mean, I know the match before was 8 minutes. I would have given that about 3 more minutes. Just not that great. DiBiase was very meticulous, and meticulous is fine with the right guy. Beefcake's not the kind of guy you're meticulous with. He's a fast-paced guy in the ring. Got to kind of keep the flow going. They didn't match well together. I didn't grade the match very well. Not that good. I'm glad this wasn't the opener. The opener, this would have really screwed the pooch in the beginning of the show if this was the opener. Not a very good.
DiBiase is kind of a weird guy. He's almost like a guy who debuted many years later in the WWF, and that's William Regal. And a guy that is a great wrestler, you know he has the technique, but he really needed a guy he could mesh with, you know, to really make things work. And Beefcake just wasn't one of those guys. It just didn't, maybe, you know, part of it not having the storyline behind it. And I'm going through Graham's site, and I don't really see anything besides a few house show matches. So I don't think they really had much of a feud on TV going on. It looks like just house show stuff, January and February. So, after Ron Bass left.
Exactly.
But so, yeah, you know, there wasn't a lot of chemistry here. The match never really gets going, and then to have the lame ending tacked on, and I get why they didn't want either guy to lose. I mean, I'm not usually a big fan of those kind of finishes on these shows, but on a show with 14 matches, and this one's kind of an innocuous one in the middle, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, again, DiBiase would actually start a feud, a much juicier feud, in a couple of months, as would Beefcake. He'd get involved, so both of them would actually go off and do better things over the next year. But this match just doesn't do it for me. The pace is just not great, and they just don't mesh well together. So, not the best effort out of two very very good guys, popular and hated, hot with the fans on both sides of the fence. Just didn't mesh well. Didn't work well together.
Nope.
So
not much there. So now we move on to another tag team match, once again showing off the depth of the tag division. Mm. And this match, well, not that tremendous, is pretty memorable for a couple of different things. One is, of course, the match is the Bushwhackers and the Fabulous Rougeau Brothers. Bushwhackers pay-per-view debut, right? Outside of the, obviously, the Rumble match, but their first actual match.
Yes, it is.
Of course, the first is, as the Bushwhackers enter, Jesse accuses Gorilla of walking through the casino like that the night before after he hit the joy juice during the night. It's always one of my favorite WrestleMania lines. And of course, the other hilarious moment comes when Ray Rougeau lifts Luke up for a body slam. And for some reason, Luke decides to massage Ray Rougeau's private area. Let's put it that way. He starts grabbing his balls for some reason. I don't understand if it was like a rib, a joke. If Lucas is a fucked up son of a bitch, I don't understand what the reasoning was. But if you have never caught that moment, I implore you to watch that match and check it out. It's about halfway through, and it's just a random body slam, but you can't miss it. I mean, it's right in plain view of the camera. It's very odd. I didn't mind this match. I wish the Rougeaus got the win. I understand why they gave it to the Bushwhackers. They were still kind of the new team, and they wanted to, you know, give them the win here. But these two teams are really pretty much feuded on and off from here through the Royal Rumble the following year, always kind of meeting on and off. So, you know, they're at the bottom of the tag team division ladder. But, you know, both teams solid in what they do. You know, I gave this match a 2. I thought it was decent enough. I like the finish where the Rougeaus are kind of huddling up, and the Bushwhackers just drill them with the Baronogram, and then finish off Jacques with the double stomach breaker. So, you know, decent match. Yeah, fine for what it was. 9 minutes of, you know, it was comedy in the beginning and then kind of boiled down to being a legit match.
Yeah, I've never been, as everyone knows, never been the biggest Bushwhackers fan. Again, not because of them in general. I liked them in other promotions when they were evil heels with their New Zealand flag and their barbed wire. I wish the Rougeaus had won, but yeah, I agree with you. You know, you kind of have no choice here. Juggling around the twig and berries, as you worded on the review, is very funny. And it actually kind of keeps – it makes you want to watch the match, even if you hate both teams or whatever. It makes you want to watch it anyway, even if it's only for a few brief seconds. It is about four – it's like 4.5 minutes in. Overall, it's not bad. It's not great. But, you know, it gives the Bushwhackers a big win on this stage. Four guys get a good payday. These two would meet again down the line. And that's about it, really. I mean, there's nothing really much to say. It's pretty straightforward. The Joy Juice line is pretty funny. And the Twig and Berries moment is pretty funny. And I mean, it is pretty clear. It's almost like Luke knew,
I mean, it had to be a rip. He must have just been fucking with him, all right?
He had to have. But, I mean, he must have known that the camera was going to be right there. I mean, if not, then it wouldn't have been as funny. But, you know, it's a memorable pay-per-view moment ever for an otherwise forgettable match. But that's pretty much it. There's not much more to say here. It's, you know, it's not bad. It's not great. Either way, it's, you know, it's back and forth. But the Bushwhackers win. I did like the double stomach breaker. That was kind of a good little double team move. I'll say I didn't have a problem with. I just couldn't stand them. They were such awesome heels when I used to watch them on ESPN, whether World Class or, you know, I used to rent some tapes where they'd be on in the Central States area, Bob Geigel's promotion. They come here and they just act like two complete idiots. And it just, I don't know, bummed me out. I thought it was a waste of a good heel team. But their work rate wasn't bad. And, you know, they were entertaining. You know, I don't hate them as much as I hate, like, you know, our other buddy who we'll talk about later. I'm sure you got the clip queued up later. Nothing earth shattering here. Just the Twig and Giggles and the Joy Juice line kind of carry the match. Our next match, on the other hand, one of my favorites, a personal favorite of mine. I know you like it as well. And there's a lot of us, and I'm looking forward to, I kind of want to hear from our loyal fan base on our Facebook page what they thought of this match in particular. Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, in his actual singles debut. He's been in a couple of Survivor Series matches and two Rumbles, but this is his actual pay-per-view singles debut.
One Rumble and one Survivor Series match.
One Rumble, one Survivor Series. Why did I think he was at 88? I don't know why I think that way. But anyway, so one each. I'm sorry. I thought he was at the 88 Rumble. Mr. Perfect, again, his singles debut, taking on the Blue Blazer. And you remember him with the great music and the big, you know, blue outfit with the big feathery cape. And obviously we all know who the Blue Blazer is. He is, you know, baby brother of the Hart clan, Owen Hart, who technically this is his pay-per-view debut, but he obviously doesn't debut as a singles wrestler himself for a couple of years.
And this is actually his final show as the Blazer.
Yeah, he never wrestles another match as well. He's supposed to wrestle one more, but we won't get to that.
No, he does later on. I mean, this is his final appearance.
For now. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Right. And the match is only 5 minutes and 38 seconds, but God, you wished it was longer.
Yes.
You know, it almost seemed like, you know, Vince and Brett probably told him, you know what, we're going to give you some time. Go out there and have some fun. You got a guy that'll be very easy to work with. And obviously Perfect, being close to the Hart family, kind of realized, we'll give the kids some fun. And I think there was a little kind of posturing here to make this a really good looking match. And again, for only 5.5 minutes, it was.
I mean, really, if they gave another 5 minutes, this could have been the Savage Steamboat of the show. It could have really stolen the show in the middle of the card. If they got another 5 minutes to kind of go out there and tear things down, because as it was, they really did. And, you know, Jesse called it as the match was beginning. He said this was his sleeper pick, you know, for the match of the night. And he was almost right if they had another, you know, 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, you almost think that they could have taken, you know, a couple minutes off the DiBiase match. Obviously, you can't, because you don't want to, you know, from a PR perspective and from a character and marketing perspective, you're not going to take minutes off of higher guys, you know, matches.
No, they could have taken it off the Bushwhacker match, though, I think.
Probably, and maybe a couple minutes off of the DiBiase beefcake. You know, it didn't have to be that long. If the game was going to end in a double count out, it didn't have to be that long. But
yeah.
you know, kudos to Perfect, who, you know, not, you know, it's kind of tough when your debut match is against a really technically sound kid. And, you know, Owen, in a weird way, yeah, he had a mask on, but, you know, I'm sure he had some jitters. I mean, you know, this is WrestleMania, you know, mm-hmm. WrestleMania 5. I mean, it's, you know, the biggest show of your life. Your brother's here. You know, I'm sure Stu was probably up backstage. Maybe, who knows, he might have been in Calgary. But, you know, it's a big moment for the kid. And he did not disappoint. And it was just a taste of what would be one of the most, one of the best careers in history for both guys. And Perfect obviously gets the win with the Perfect Plex. But there were a couple of moments where Owen, where you thought the Blazer, well, you know, maybe. Just
oh,
maybe.
Yeah, definitely. And again, here there was some nasty spot. You know, for WrestleMania, not really known for its in-ring action, there's a lot of, like, memorable, very stiff spots and moves. And there's a mm-hmm. few here. One is Perfect takes a dropkick, and he flies right over the top to the floor, which is pretty mm-hmm. good. And one of the nastiest spots I've seen, Owen does a flying splash off the top rope, and Perfect gets his knees up, and he lands right on his knees flush.
Yeah.
So that was a good bump. And then right before the finish, Owen is jawjacking with the referee about you know, what he thought was a three count. And he turns around and Perfect just decks him in the face. And Owen yeah. just sells it tremendously. Just a great, great punch. And then he locks in the Perfect Plex for the win. So just really good stuff here. Crisp, effective, and it made Perfect, you know, really look like a great wrestler.
Yes. And after this, we see the end of the Blue Blazer for mm-hmm. the moment. Owen leaves, goes back up to a Stampede. And then he actually heads down to Memphis for a little bit. Works with Lawler's with the Memphis Power Pro promotion.
Yeah, he was all you know. He did some Japan as well.
Yeah, so he definitely sowed his oats over the next, you know, 2.5 years.
And actually, some WCW, right? A couple dark matches.
He does. Yeah, he does get
a couple job matches rather.
Yeah. So he gets around. They did the right thing with Owen. They kind of let him float out and do his own thing and kind of sow his oats a little bit. And then they bring him back a few years later with some more experience when the roster needed some fresh blood. Really, they didn't need any fresh blood now. Mm-hmm. Roster was jacked. So, you know, it was pointless to have him hang around here for nothing. So they let him go sow his oats and, you know, get some work in and, you know, and have him come back. So they were smart. They did the right thing with Owen. And, again, a great match. Perfect wins. But 5 more minutes, and you're right. It could have been – who knows what it could have been. We could be talking about it reverently like Savage Steamboat or you know, 5 years later when Owen would face his brother.
And speaking of reverently, that brings us to our next segment, which I reverently consider one of the worst WrestleMania segments of all time. Ugh. I've always despised that segment. Now, WrestleMania 5, I probably should mention this in the beginning, this was the first wrestling video I ever rented. It was WrestleMania 5, and I would go on to rent it dozens of times over the next, you know, few years when they, you know, the video stores only had so many you could watch. So
right.
This was one I rented a lot because it was a long show. You got your money's worth, I felt like. Right. I always, and this is someone, you know, you're talking to someone who devoured everything wrestling. I always fast forwarded that stupid Run DMC rap.
Yeah, I did too.
I'm a rap fan. I thought that was a stupid. It sounded like they just kept saying WrestleMania over and over, and you could barely hear what the rest of the stuff they were mumbling. So I would have axed that and gave that whole time to Perfect to Blazer.
Yeah,
you probably would have been better off, but you know, I understand. Run DMC was hot at that point, so.
Yeah, and let me. That was a two taper, right?
No.
No,
four was the only two taper I ever saw.
Oh, okay. I remember the three tapes that I used to rent consistently when I first watched wrestling was the Best of the WWF Volume 2, WrestleMania 1, and the PWI Lords of the Ring, which was a compilation from the mid-80s. Those are the first three tapes, and I used to rent them from my video place, Video Box Office, which is right on the Orange Milford line here in Connecticut. And I used to just rent those three just like crazy because that's all they had. And then finally started matriculating some more, and then I remember renting this. I watched this live, and then I rented it when it came out a couple of months later. It took a lot longer back then. Didn't it seem like it took a lot longer? I mean, this was April 2nd. I don't think the tape came out till like June 5th or something, it seemed like.
Yeah.
It seemed like it took so much longer for tapes back then, but obviously – technology is not as good as it is now.
I think the main ones I'd rent were this 5-4 and SummerSlam and Survivor Series 89, Rumble 90. Like those five were the ones I rotated heavily.
So why don't you open up the next match for us? Another memorable one.
And another tag match.
Yes.
My third straight. Again, showing off the depth. And this is our tag team title match, and that's finally ending the feud between Demolition and Powers of Pain that started at Survivor Series when Mr. Fuji turned on Demolition. Mm-hmm. Here he actually sides with the Powers of Pain as part of the match. It's actually a handicap match, 3-on-2. And some funny moments leading up. They had a good brawl on Saturday Night's Main Event prior to the show. Actually, I think they actually had a match that kind of fell into a brawl afterwards, and just kind of, it was either on Superstars or Saturday Night's Main Event. I can't remember. It might have actually been Superstars. But then, of course, they would show the Fuji training for this match by him running the WrestleMania 5K in a tuxedo and eventually finishing it. That's the clip they show before this match to show him preparing to get back in the ring.
Of course, he cheated.
Yes, of course. Well, according to Gorilla, he cheated. We don't know for sure.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So.
Solid power match. I like the psychology and the storyline throughout. It was, you know, whether or not Fuji was more effective on the outside of the ring than he was inside the ring. And Gorilla kind of hammers that home at the end after Fuji gets pinned. When Demolition retains, he says, you know, maybe Fuji would have been better off staying on the floor where he could have interfered instead of getting the shit kicked out of him by Demolition.
Yeah, obviously the big storyline hook here, and Jesse and Gorilla are bantering it throughout the match, is having Fuji here. Jesse's like, you know, Gorilla, you know, he was a former, you know, world tag team, you know, former world tag team champion, you know, he's guy's a legend in the tag team ranks. And Gorilla's like, yeah, that was 10 years ago. He's dead weight now. So they're bouncing around, and obviously typical handicap match involving a manager, you know, Powers of Pain made sure to get Fuji in only when they had the advantage. And obviously Fuji, master of the salt to the face, tries to do it here. It backfires, and they hit Fuji with the decapitation device to retain their championships. Crowd's pretty hot. Obviously Demolition way over, not as over as they would be a year later, obviously a bigger crowd, but, you know, pretty good match, nice win for Demolition. They've held the belts for almost over a year now.
Yes.
And really solidified the titles. Actually, in my opinion, having them keep the titles, I don't know if you agree with this or not, and I'm curious to see what our fans think of this. I almost feel like them keeping the titles made the tag division stronger, because it just made all these other teams just hunger for being number one, that they just had awesome matches against each other. And, you know, with the tag titles not being bounced around so much, it almost made the rest of the division that much better, because they were trying to,
definitely. And it made them seem like unbeatable monsters. I mean, you know, no one could topple this team for over a year now. And, you know, with each successive WrestleMania, they continue to get bigger pops. Like, the win of four get a pretty good pop, even though they were a heel team. Here they get a very good pop, and of course we'll see at WrestleMania 6 how things go. But another solid match. It really hasn't been a bad match yet. We haven't had a great match, but they've all been, you know, solid to very good so far. So the show is off to a hot start through the first six matches. And again, the commentary is good here. Like I said, the story of the match was good, and Fuji just couldn't get it done. So now his master plan backfired on him.
Yes, and Demolition retains the World Tag Team Championships. Next, our first legit throwaway filler go take a leak match. Dino Bravo takes on Ronnie Garvin. Obviously a match I could care less about. I don't think anybody really cared. The only interesting part of this match was right before the match, they announced the huge return of Jimmy Snuka.
Yes.
Which is very strange, where the two guys were introduced. Oh, by the way, look, everyone, it's Jimmy Snuka.
Yeah, that was very odd. And actually, as much as I hate Frenchie Martin, who's pretty funny here, like kind of shooing Snuka out of the way, like, who gives a shit about you, as he was coming to the ring. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, that was very funny. Otherwise, the match is really nothing much. It's a few minutes long. You know, Bravo wins with his side suplex, and Garvin jobs like he should. And he gets involved in actually a pretty hilarious storyline, and one of his greatest pay-per-view moments in either of his federations, NWA or WWF, comes at the next show. Mm-hmm. Infamously, of course. But this match is simple fodder. Just kind of give the chance to hit the slots real quick, go take a leak, and shot of joy juice, which you probably need to watch this match, and move on. So nothing to see here. Dino Bravo wins. Ron Garvin loses, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And this is actually it for your boy Frenchie Martin. He's done after this.
You must be thrilled.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So relieved. Is Dino Bravo move on to a new manager, as we'll see later in the year. Yes. Okay, so next up, we have yet again another tag match, once again showing off the depth. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a dream match of sorts, because it's really a match on paper that looked tremendous heading into the show, and that is the Brainbusters, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson, taking on Strikeforce, the returning Strikeforce, Tito Santana, Rick Martel. Now, of course, Martel came back early in 1989. He was by himself, and then Tito, according to Martel in his little post-match ranting, Tito begged him to team back up, or it was Tito's idea for them to team back up, even though Martel claims he wanted to keep going on his own. So the match starts very hot. All four guys, NWA-style kind of brawl. You know, Strikeforce gets the double figure four, and the Brainbusters are doing their little shtick, and things are going well for Strikeforce until Tito accidentally hits Martel with the flying burrito, knocking Martel out of the floor. Martel dramatically oversells this for the next couple of minutes, stomping around on the apron, holding his head, as Tito started to get picked apart by the Brainbusters. Eventually, Martel left, walked out on Tito, officially ending Strikeforce and officially turning Martel heel. What would commence is one of the greatest WrestleMania heel beatdowns of all time, as the Brainbusters just destroy Tito and finish him with a great spike pile driver that Tito sells like death. And the Brainbusters get the win to ignite what would become a very hot summer for them. And, of course, the highlight as well was Martel's post-match rant backstage, where he officially ends Strikeforce, because Tito Santana is nothing but a loser, and I've been carrying him.
Tremendous French-Canadian accent, and he ended up being from Cocoa Beach, Florida, so I don't know. But, the whole package is tremendous. One of my favorite – I almost wanted to give this a 5 just for my own personal benefit, but I couldn't see me doing that. But it was amazing, though, how – and this is what I loved about that summer of tag team wrestling, and you hit the nail on the head. Arn and Tully just brought that aura of just good, solid NWA brawling into these very systematic, pretty, kind of almost dainty tag matches in WWF, and they brought this rough and rugged, just like shit-pounding kind of offense and to the WWF, and Tito just sold it like he was just getting mugged in an alley. Tito did that well for the next 4 or 5 years. But obviously Martel was ready to explode as a big time heel, and he does call Tito a loser, and it's pretty classic. It's a classic moment, and the match itself as a whole is really nothing that great, but it's not terrible, but it's more the systematic dissection of Tito by just two awesome heel wrestlers,
right,
who just know their way around the ring. And again, to me, I think it adds another dimension to this tremendous tag division.
Mm-hmm.
These two guys who aren't, they're not good looking by any stretch. They're not chiseled. They're not jacked. They don't have big, crazy gimmicks. They're just two guys who could just kick the crap out of you with systematic precision. And, all you needed was, Flair with a figure four and Ole with a knee to your skull off the top rope. And, you had the Four Horsemen, man. And that just made them great. It was just great to see this team in the WWF mingling with all these other different kinds of teams. That's what made this tag division so great. Just everybody was different. Every tag team, not just a different look, but a different style of wrestling. It's just so unique. And it's what's missing in the tag divisions now. Even in the Attitude Era, you didn't see this. There were a lot of pretty decent tag teams in the Attitude Era, but not like this. Just every team had their own look. And not just their own gimmick in terms of characters, but just a different style of wrestling. And Arn and Tully did a great job of kind of mingling that NWA hardcore, not hardcore like weapons, but just straight up brawling and just beating on people. Nothing pretty about it. They could smile, wear their nice suits, and cut their awesome promos with their monogrammed cuffs, but then get in the ring and they're just gonna cream you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made the match. That's what made this moment so great. And obviously Ricky Martel. His heel turn, because Tito's a loser.
And, yeah, it was a good heel turn. I mean, Strikeforce is just going to be buried in this tag division anyway at this point. They were pretty far down the face ladder. So, Martel obviously would end up making a pretty good heel, and these two would feud endlessly over the next few years. So,
right.
I think it was an effective heel turn. I like the way they did it, and I think it was good for both men that they were able to kind of split away from Strikeforce and branch out on their own.
Exactly. And so Brainbusters win. Big things set for them, and we'll get more on that in our next vault. And Strikeforce is officially finished. Windbreakers and all. We'll miss the girls and cars, but it's because Tito's a loser.
Yes.
Ricky Martel, listen to me. Ricky, I sound like Larry Nelson. Ricky Martel, obviously he stays just Martel for the next few months. He doesn't really go over his major character makeover till later on in the year.
Right.
We'll get to that towards Survivor Series. Then we'd get another another skit, and it is the return of the Hot Rod, the Hot Scott. No, not Kieran. The original Hot Scott. Rowdy Roddy Piper makes his return to the World Wrestling Federation.
It's pretty funny that both Piper and Snuka return on the same pay-per-view.
Yes, that's true. Piper, who of course has been off camera for almost exactly 2 years, he obviously, his last moment on camera was when he was triumphantly, actually one of my favorite, we talked about it when we did that vault, I think one of our just personal great feel-good moments in history.
Yep.
When Piper wheeled out of the Silverdome at WrestleMania 3 after beating Adrian Adonis. Just a feel-good moment. You really did legitimately think he was never coming back, but, you know, it's the Hot Rod. He doesn't stay away for long. And he actually does a Piper's Pit here. And
well, he doesn't come out first. First is Brother Love, dressed as Roddy Piper, comes out.
Right, yes. Brother Love comes out with his creamy knees, his Ken Patera-esque legs, and his kilt. And his guest is Morton Downey Jr. Now, for those that are a little younger, don't know who he is. Morton Downey Jr. was a very controversial talk show host who had one of those Springer-esque shows, and he was just an absolute, just pardon my French, just an absolute fucking asshole. Yeah. on all levels.
That's obvious.
His TV show was hideous, and he was just a jerk. And then Piper came out, place went bonkers.
No, he's dead, right, Morton Downey Jr.? Yeah, he died in 2001.
Yeah, he died in 2001. I think he had throat cancer because he smoked like 50 packs a day.
Yeah, 96, he had lung cancer. Had one of his lungs removed. He changed his stance from being a member of the National Smokers Alliance and became a staunch anti-smoking activist.
Yes. Well, because it pretty much killed him in reality. So, and ironically, smoking is what led to the comedy part of the skit. Every time Piper's trying to ask him a question, Morton Downey's blowing smoke in his face. And after like the fourth time of doing it, Piper's had enough, pulls out a fire extinguisher and blows it in and fires it in Morton Downey's face.
I said it before, don't blow no smoke in my face.
Yeah. Everybody's Canadian accent came out of this pay-per-view. He's supposed to be from Glasgow, Scotland, and all of a sudden the Winnipeg accent comes out.
Actually, I liked Brother Love's Piper impression. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, no, it was. And Brother Love was a good character. Have we really mentioned him yet? Yeah, we did. We mentioned
SummerSlam. We didn't really get into it. I don't think we even really talked about him. We mentioned that who he was, but he was portrayed by Bruce Pritchard, just kind of being like a televangelist ripoff gimmick, kind of like Jimmy Swagger and those guys who would preach every weekend around that time when they were pretty big. And so it was basically just a knockoff of and I think it was hinted, if they never came out and said it, that DiBiase was his benefactor. I believe he said that before. My benefactor. So
yes, that's right. I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. So that was his role. He's basically just a corrupt preacher who had his own little talk show, kind of filled in when Piper's Pit left, and they kind of filled that void. So
right, exactly. And I read somewhere that did it come? I don't know if you told me or somebody told me that Morton Downey Jr. actually wrestled in college or wrestled in high school, and he actually went after Piper after spraying him with the fire extinguisher.
Yes.
And actually,
Piper
tried to, like,
said that, I think.
Yeah, he was going to try to take it, like, give him a leg, like a lower leg takedown or something. He started, like, grabbing at his legs, and I don't know what was going on.
I didn't realize this. Apparently, in the Super Mario Bros. Video game, one of the characters, Morton Cooper Jr., was named after him.
Really?
That's kind of random.
Yeah, it is random. I didn't know that either. So, so there's your Piper moment. Just another filler. It's like, 20, 25-minute fill to get you through. Our next match... Man, you literally are getting every single tag match.
Another tag match. And this is... it's not.
No, I have a match before that, but I was just realizing that you'll be doing the next match, which is another tag. Gotcha. I have another singles match. And it's another good feud that started before Survivor Series. And that is Jake the Snake Roberts taking on Andre the Giant. This obviously all involves Damian. They were sort of feuding in the early fall. And then they met at... their teams met at Survivor Series, and Andre just beat the crap out of them. Beat Jake down, and then Jake got Andre to eliminate himself at the Royal Rumble by whipping out Damian, and we get to this match. And the big issue here is the special guest referee, which is the freshly minted Royal Rumble winner, Big John Studd. And obviously they were assuming, I guess, at the time that Stud was going to make a comeback. Little did they realize within a few years Stud would get cancer. But
I mean, even before that, I think they realized he was done. I mean, he feuded with Akeem post-Rumble. But I think they had plans to really run another Andre Stud feud on the house show circuit at this point, which I can't believe they even considered that. But this match was announced on 218, and Stud as the ref was announced right away as well.
Okay. So obviously the match is fairly average. I mean, you know, Jake is a lot like DiBiase, another guy who just for some reason at WrestleMania stage, the matches are just average when you feel they should be better. This one, you can kind of give him the benefit of the doubt because at this point, Andre was just, and God bless you, boss, but Andre was just completely useless at this point. I mean, he couldn't move. He was in a lot of pain. I don't know why they were pushing him. I was kind of hoping eventually, I was getting really upset at this point. I wanted Andre to turn face again, and they hadn't done it. And he just looked sad, and it's unfortunate because I hate saying that about an absolute legend of the business, but at this point, I don't know why they were pushing him out there doing matches.
Here's actually an interesting little match. On the February 15th Superstars taping, but I'm guessing this was probably a dark match, Stud was supposed to fight Akeem, like he did in every house show pretty much from January and February, but Akeem wasn't there, so Jake actually subbed for him and fought Stud. So it's kind of a weird weird match.
Very interesting. I don't know why they didn't bring out... Oh, this is weird. I don't know where they. Why didn't they just bring out Boss Man?
Stud did feud with Boss Man as well throughout these months. He basically mainly fought Akeem. He had a few matches with Boss Man. I'm kind of going through now because I'm trying to see if they did anything with him and Andre.
Yeah. No. It's an unfortunate match. In that it just Andre just doesn't have it anymore, and I almost feel guilty. Having to say these things about Andre because I love the guy. He's one of our first heroes, first Hall of Famer. But just by this point, he was just utterly useless. It's unfortunate, and the match just suffers because of it.
And he did he did feud with Andre, throughout the spring here. Looks like Haku and Duggan often got involved in things, but they did have a pretty extensive house show feud into May. Even I'm trying to find when his last appearance was, but he actually stuck around for a while, and he had some TV matches as well. Which is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, so just not a great match, and Andre just didn't have much left in the tank. So it's unfortunate, but the disease that took over his body was just getting to the point now where he really couldn't do much anymore. So
you know, I read somewhere recently that he actually had a chance to have a surgery, but decided not to. That could have maybe helped him.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't.
I don't know if that's legit or not. I can't remember where I read it. It was just something talking about Andre. It looks like Stud's last match was June 4th against Andre in Cincinnati. After that, he was subbed for by Hillbilly Jim throughout the circuit. So it looks like June 4th is when they kind of pulled the plug.
Okay. Probably realizing the matches weren't...
I lied. He came back one more time. June 26th in Glens Falls. Him and Duggan fought Andre and Haku.
Oh, look at that.
And that's
Duggan in his...
Yep, and that's his last match.
Hometown arena.
He was subbed for again by Hillbilly a couple days later. So
okay. Obviously, they must have been looking at these matches going, God, this is not good. It's just not good. And trying to rekindle WrestleMania 1, which was an awesome hot feud, wasn't working here. So it's unfortunate. But
yeah, and he would eventually, after that feuding, Stud and Andre. And you could tell they were splintering off a little bit here because, you know, DiBiase comes out during the match and steals Damian. And Jake goes out and fights with DiBiase and Virgil in the aisle. And Andre and Stud start chopping. And you know, Andre smacks Stud, drawing the DQ. And then they start fighting in the ring. So you could kind of tell they were splitting those two people off. And, you know, Jake was going on to feud with DiBiase. And Andre and Stud were supposed to feud. And Stud obviously would leave in June. Kind of disappeared from the wrestling business, eventually would pass away in 1995, yes. Inducted to the Hall of Fame in 2004.
Yes, he would end up getting some form of cancer.
Hodgkin's, and liver cancer and Hodgkin's disease.
Hodgkin's, yeah, not a fun combination. And I believe he did, I think I said this in a previous podcast, I believe he did own a couple of 7-Elevens or convenience stores, something like that. He had money, he didn't die broke.
Yeah.
As far as we know. He saved his money and was making some money after his retirement. So, all right. I, the singles booker of this pay-per-view, pass off to my partner, who is the tag team booker of this pay-per-view, as he introduces our, fourth tag match?
Is it fourth or fifth?
Yeah, because this is the 10th match, and you've done the evens, and I think every one has been a tag match.
Yeah, so as we said, this is actually the final tag match, but a hot stacked division, and we have the former champion, the Hart Foundation, kind of lost in the shuffle a little bit, as they would be for actually kind of the next year. Still putting on quality matches, still involved in feuds, but not really seen as legit contenders right now.
Right.
Kind of working their way back up against a new team that's kind of been put together because two guys that had nothing else going on, and that's Honky Tonk Man and Greg Valentine. Now, the Not Yet Rhythm and Blues, that would come in 1990.
Right.
But here, it's just kind of Jimmy Hart's stable mates. And I think they teamed quite a bit just around the circuit and on TV at this point. Just another solid match. Not really much going on here. It's just 7 minutes and well worked. The Harts win after Brett pops Honky with Jimmy's megaphone when he tosses in the ring, gets the win. So, good win for the Harts. Hammer and Valentine really, they could lose endlessly. It didn't really matter at this point. So, they take the loss here. The Harts move on.
Yeah. The Hart Foundation, unfortunately, solid guys, but need to fill out the division somehow. And it's kind of tough when you're pretty much the number two babyface team. That's essentially what they were. They were the number two babyface team in the company behind the Champs Demolition, and they weren't losing anytime soon. And if they were, it wasn't going to be the Hart Foundation. Not yet, anyway. This is Honky and Greg Valentine's chance to, get a part of the big payday and part of the post-WrestleMania party. Not much more to say. You're four professional guys put on a good match. Probably another match where people probably walked over to the casino and threw some coin in the slots, another shot of joy juice, but at least this is more watchable than Dino Bravo and Ronnie Garvin. But just another chance for four guys to get a payday. The match was solid, but nothing spectacular. The Hart Foundation's next pay-per-view match, I'll be gushing over. Wait till we get to that one next week. But it's one of the greatest tag matches of all time. But we'll give you that when we get there. Here, nothing fancy, but chance for four guys to get a paycheck and Hart Foundation get a bit of a workout in. But, solid match enough for four professionals, and that's pretty much it for there. We kind of move along. Our next match is the second championship match on our card. It is for the, of course, Intercontinental title. The champion, the Ultimate Warrior, as Vince used to say, taking on another hot heel and a new hot member of Bobby's family, and that is, of course, Ravishing Rick Rude. And this was Jesse Ventura's crowning moment as a color commentator. He called this the big upset. No one believed him. And
he was a huge Rude fan all along, as we stated during Rude's debut, between the Slammies and the Jesse the Body Award and everything else. He's always been Rude and Savage were his guys. And Rude really here was, this is like Jesse's crowning moment as a commentator. As far as having like a guy he roots for.
Yes, and obviously, as you'll know, listening through time, Jesse, not the biggest Ultimate Warrior fan in the world.
No.
Might be a guy that he hates even more than Hogan. Not on this night, but down the line. I like this match. They do much better at SummerSlam, but I really like this match. Again, the first of what? Three consecutive WrestleManias where a guy who everyone thinks is a dumb, single faceted piece of meat comes out and really puts on a good solid WrestleMania match.
Yes.
And Rude, who had his moments, I think Rude got a lot. I can comfortably say, and maybe you disagree or agree, and maybe our great listeners will comment on our Facebook page. I think Rude was very good here, but I don't think he really hit his stride until he went to WCW. But
in ring, yes. I mean, he was very good, but yeah, he became great, an all-time great for that two-year stretch before he got hurt in WCW.
Yeah, no. Character-wise, he's awesome here. Awesome.
Yes, and even in the ring. I mean, he does carry Warrior to a pretty damn good match here.
Yes, he does. I'm not saying, please don't get me wrong. I'm not slamming Rude's ability whatsoever. I just think that he really hit his stride once he got to WCW. But this match is very, very good. And Rude really kind of brings the goods here.
I like the opening. Warrior has the belt on, and Rude tries to give him the knee, and he knees the belt. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I like that too. That's pretty cool. I believe Rude comes out with the belt on his tights. I believe he.
He had the pink tights with the belt on this one.
With the belt on him, and then I remember my brother getting – this might have been my brother's – because I think he knew what the end of the show was going to be like. So he was pumping himself up for a moment he would enjoy. Of course, he loved his two of his favorite guys, Arn and Tully, destroyed Tito. This is probably my brother's second favorite moment this night. And after putting up – trying to get Rude up for a regular suplex over the top rope, Bobby would pull Warrior's foot and Rude would fall on top of Warrior and Bobby would – it's almost like Bobby was holding – Warrior's foot so hard that if he let go, he'd fall into the gates of hell. That's how hard he was holding his foot. But he held it down long enough. Rude got the three count. And finally, after 4.5 years of being ridiculed and picked on and laughed at, Bobby Heenan has a champion in his stable.
Mm-hmm.
On this night, Rick Rude became your new Intercontinental Champion. Bobby Jesse was flipping out. Gorilla was flipping out. Merciless cheating. And Bobby didn't – and he was just insane, and Warrior was chasing him. It was just an unbelievable – just the whole package was great.
And now two moments I want to mention. One was another stiff spot, and that's when Rude drills Warrior with a nasty pile driver.
Yes.
Really stiff, and Warrior sold it beautifully.
Yep.
The other moment comes after the match when Rude leaves with the belt, and Warrior beats the piss out of Heenan in the ring, mm-hmm. drops into the press slam, and hits the big splash. So that would play a role later in the night. But Heenan, as Jesse said, Bobby's got his gold, so nothing really hurt him at that point.
No, and, you know, Jesse had his great moment, his guy was champ, and again, you know, for those that forget, you know, some of our younger wrestling fans who may not know, Bobby was a championship manager. He managed Nick Bockwinkle in the AWA when he was world champion feuding with Vern Gagne. So this wasn't Bobby's first taste of gold at all. This is Bobby's first taste of WWF gold. And Rick Rude is his Intercontinental Champion. So Warrior loses, but this feud is just beginning. And if you think I'm gushing about it now, wait till we open up the vault next week. I'll be all over this feud like white on rice. So, but right now, you know, Rude swipes the title with a boatload of tomfoolery. And Bobby is a managing a champion for the first time in his WWF career. So.
Yep. Good match. Good stuff. Yes. And, you know, the continuation of what would extend on to be a very good feud.
Yes. Yes. Hey, right. Look, you got a singles match.
And it's a great one, right?
Yeah.
Features,
yeah,
right. You know, the man who I always say is ahead of his time, Bad News Brown, against mm-hmm. the man of your dreams, Jim Duggan. I got my 2x4. I got the American flag. Now, this match really wasn't much. It's only just under 4 minutes. Typical brawling that you'd expect. And as always, the masters of the double disqualification, double count out, bullshit finish, both of these guys wrestle to a double DQ here, as you would expect. The highlight, of course, was when Duggan, sitting in the chair after the match, had a big snot hanging off his nose, and Jesse calls him out on it, which was disgusting. Tremendous stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely disgusting.
It ends because Bad News grabs a chair, and Duggan grabs a board, and they just start like hammering away at each other. So really, you know, not much here, and it's just a chance to get both of these guys on the card.
Yeah, it's and I make a comment on our review. And again, folks, while you're listening, please. You know, I had a discussion with our friend Matt Rotella the other day about why did you pick the absolute worst piece of crap song for him? I would rather you play his regular theme than that piece of garbage.
You can thank Simon Cowell for that, Jim.
Yeah, I was going to say, Simon Cowell should not be proud of this. I don't think Duggan's going to be on the X Factor in the fall, that's for sure. Bad News Brown is part of that. Actually, both these guys, really, but Bad News Brown in particular is part of that non-finish faction. Him, Ted DiBiase, Jake Roberts, and Roddy Piper, four guys who I think have lost clean a total of like three times in their whole career. And then you got the other guy who needs to be protected all the time because, God forbid, you know, Jim Duggan ever loses a match. God knows why. You know,
I am a little surprised that they didn't get Bad News the win here because he was still – I guess he had kind of winded down his house show run with Savage, but I think he still had the one with Hogan coming up. So I'm a little surprised maybe to just have him take the win.
Yeah, I am too. I just don't understand why this guy constantly got protected. He got in trouble, for Christ's sakes, with the Iron Sheik, and they ended up firing him. And this guy gets non-finishes to protect himself. I don't know. It's another crap match, just like Dino Bravo and Garvin. Another Joy Juice shot and a couple of pulls of the slot, and then back to your seat. Because you don't want to miss the next match. Well, you don't want to miss the next match. It didn't work out this way. I thought maybe you'd be able to do this one, but Bobby Heenan, of course, two matches before, got his crowning moment now managing Intercontinental Champion Ravishing Rick Rude, but then took a good beating by the Ultimate Warrior at the end, now has to come out and actually wrestle a match as he takes on one of his former protégés, Terry Taylor, a.k.a. The Red Rooster. Now, the Red Rooster ends up turning babyface and then ended up getting a red mohawk. Don't ask me why.
He really took on, you know, it would have made more sense if he didn't embrace the name instead if he got rid of it, you know, shedding the attachment to Heenan after he finally turned on him.
Right.
You know, he grew tired of Heenan's coaching and bitching and moaning, and he finally turned on him.
Right.
And then Bobby would bring in some muscle of his own in the man that was the jobber for most of the 1980s, and that's Steve Lombardi. Mainly used his enhancement talent up until this point. Repackaged here as a Brooklyn Brawler. Started wearing torn jeans, cigar, Yankee shirt. And, you know, Heenan brought him under his tutelage to take out the Rooster as revenge. And, of course, they would have a famous moment with Brooklyn Brawler when he showed up on Primetime Wrestling. Was Rooster on when he came out and did that thing with Gorilla? Is that why he came out? I know he comes out and they get into a little fight. Or Brawler comes out and was arguing with something. He ends up hitting Gorilla with a chair and knocking him down, which is a pretty cool moment to see on Primetime.
I believe so. I'll have to look that up. I'll have to look that up on Graham's history of WWE site. I think Rooster was on the set. I believe he was.
Think so too. And the main reason Bobby went with Lombardi is saying that, you know, Rooster is useless and he can take anyone and make them a star. So that's why he ended up picking Lombardi.
It's funny because obviously by the time you became a fan towards the end of the year, Brawler wasn't really around much. But I'm assuming if you were a little older, I'm sure you would have become a big.
Well, he was around. I mean, you know, he was a jobber for a long time.
Right, but I mean, at this point, he was actually treated like sort of a mid-card guy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. By the time I started watching, he was job fodder, but he was on regularly. He and Rooster was on. There's a YouTube clip. I'm not watching it, but it says in the title, Brooklyn Brawler attacks Terry Taylor and Gorilla Monsoon on Primetime.
Yeah. Well, Brooklyn, you know, Steve Lombardi, he should be very happy that he actually got a legitimate, you know, moment. It doesn't take a lot, you know, Gorilla doesn't take shots for anybody. So. And he was one step away from being Mr. Perfect.
Yes.
I don't think Kurt Hennig's hair could have made a mohawk either. So, sorry, Terry, you're stuck. But, yeah, there you go. The Red Rooster wins. Bobby obviously banged up a bit after his guy's win, Rick Rude, and Ultimate Warrior beat him up, and he was a little banged up. And fortunately, this match was only 32 seconds.
Yeah, the whole story, like we said, you know, Warrior kicked his ass, and so he was in no condition to really fight here. But he comes out anyway, and, you know, he could have backed out, but Bobby followed through this commitment, said he was going to be there, and he came out. And then, of course, Brooklyn Brawler beats the shit out of Rooster after the match.
Yes, and I'm assuming they had a house show. They wrestled a legitimate house show feud.
Rooster. Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And Brawler, right. Well, here we go. Moment's yours, my friend. Here we are. Here is our main event. Why don't you set the table for us?
And, this of course, it is the culmination of the one-year storyline of the Mega Powers, and they are about to explode. Now, we've talked about the majority of the build-up on our last podcast. We went through the whole issue on the main event with Hogan and the Savage fighting the Twin Towers. Elizabeth gets knocked out. Hogan goes, carries her to the back, and Savage pretty much officially turns heel there fighting with Hogan. Heading into the show, Liz was in down the middle, said she couldn't choose between the two of them, so she was going to just be at ringside between the two guys. And, of course, from here on out, Jesse Ventura completely over, just takes over the show on commentary, just really puts on a clinic of heel commentary. And it starts when Savage comes out first, and he goes on a big rant as to how the champion is always supposed to come out last. And that pretty much sets the tone for his anger throughout the rest of this match.
Yes, and it's almost a 180 because, a couple matches earlier, he is an absolute rapture as his guy Rick Rude wins the Intercontinental title. And now, he legitimately is gushing here for Macho Man. He's like, Macho Man, I applaud you. You are a great champion. And in reality, he was. I mean, he really did, you know, even though he swerved from face to heel, he really did have a hell of a reign as champion. I mean, he was on almost every Saturday.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
You know, he wrestled almost every Saturday Night's main event. He was in, he wrestled almost every televised show you could possibly think of. It was a legitimately good 1 year run for Savage in terms of in the ring. And again, I mean, the thing we got to keep hanging our hats on here is this is the most disjointed, silly, feud in the sense that just Hogan looks like a complete smarmy worm, and really, I'm even amazed now, as you're watching it in 1989, how even then a lot of people probably didn't. Well, my brother figured it out because he hated Hogan anyway, so it didn't matter. But that anyone could figure out that Hogan was being the babyface here, it just didn't. I don't know. Maybe the Kool-Aid was really flowing heavy and still in that tail end of the 80s, but it just Hogan just looks like such a freeloading worm, and Savage was the unlikely sucker to let, you know, his woman kind of be free like that or something. I don't know. But
You know, Hogan was just the guy that everyone was supposed to love, and that's how he was positioned. So anyone who turns on him or fights with him was the heel. Unfortunately, that's just how it was.
And what a champion he's been this past year, winning the title 1 year ago. And right here, right here in Atlantic City, coming back tonight to proudly defend that title that he's defended for a full year. Macho, my hat's off to you. You are a great champion.
Great work by Jesse.
Yeah, and considering, you know, what's going on this week, the last few days, that's tough to listen to, because he did have a great run that year. He was just, you know, considering the things we've been reading on websites now about the relationship he had with Vince before something happened, God knows what, and we'll never know. But him and Vince were just so tight, and, you know, regardless of the fact that he had to lay down here, Savage just deserves all the credit for carrying the storyline to unbelievable levels. I think really Macho should get a lot of credit for doing his best to really put Hogan over as the good guy, even though he was a smarmy worm.
Yeah.
You know, he deserves a lot of credit for.
Oh, yeah. He really threw himself into the role.
I mean, yeah. And again, another emotional storyline that you just can't get anywhere else from any other guy. The match is awesome. It's absolutely awesome. And, you know, Savage was working with an arm injury. I remember somebody mentioned it on our Facebook page when we were doing our tribute podcast earlier in the week. One of Savage's arms was wrapped at the elbow. Didn't matter. Still carried a big lump of nothing to a really, really good match. Crowd's hot. You know, the whole Elizabeth dynamic is just sparkling.
Right. So she was at ringside in the corner. And, you know, Jesse was great to saying how, you know, she was a gold digger and she was just going to go with the winner. And whenever Hogan was on top, you know, she was moving towards his corner. And Savage was on top, she was going towards that way. And Jesse was just tremendous here. Eventually, of course, Savage uses Elizabeth to turn the tide on Hogan. And Dave Hebner throws Elizabeth out. And Jesse loves it every minute of it when Liz gets tossed out. I really liked, I just watched this match again very recently. And I really loved the back and forth of it. Neither guy really controls for that long. It's just a lot of back and forth action. Every time you think, you know, it was going one way, they would swerve it and turn it around and go the other way. Hogan, of course, blades, which added to things. And this match is just really pretty frenetic pace for 18 minutes between these two guys. They don't really ever slow down too much.
No, not at all. And and that's one thing I will give Hogan credit for. He kept up Macho's pace. Yes. Didn't let the match drag down. Crowd is just off the charts. Jesse is beside himself. I mean, he's jumping out of his skin.
And Gorilla's don't forget, too, the awesome bump Savage takes when Hogan just tosses him out over the top rope. He goes flying in the air to the floor.
Yeah, he was pretty high in the air. I mean, it was a decent 12, 14, 15 feet in the midair, and then he hits hard on the padded outside. You know, it's just a perfect package of wrestling psychology. I actually just watched it recently as well because, over the weekend, I threw in Savage's DVD again, and I watched that match. And, you know, the guy was a maestro. He just knew – he figured it out. Mm-hmm. We had said that he figured it out by WrestleMania 3. You know, the Memphis stuff just didn't work anymore, and he needed to bring the goods in the ring. And it's now been 2 years since that legendary match with Steamboat, and he definitely knows it now.
And just the speed and quickness and grace he wrestled with, where, you know, he could brawl and mix it up, but he just was so fast.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I mean he could take any kind of opponent, in this case Hogan, and make the guy look like $1 million. I really don't think. I think everybody loves his character and the colorful costumes and you know and his promos, just nonsense, gibberish sometimes. But when the guy brought it in the ring, he brought it in the ring. And I don't think he ever – I don't think he truly gets enough credit for that sometimes. But here, you know, he knew he was going down. He knew he was going to lose. A lot of people don't think he deserved to, including Jesse and my brother. But he did it with grace, and he did it with style. Unfortunately, his character run would take a real sharp turn from this show and kind of be in the dumps for a couple of years. But this is just a great match. And Jesse, you know, it's amazing. I know a lot of people, including you, are big fans of Gorilla and Bobby as a broadcast team. And I am as well. But to me, just nobody is better at just putting over anybody, everybody, and anything like Jesse did.
Yeah, they were. I mean, those two teams are very different.
Yes, they were.
Gorilla and Jesse were very real. They brought a lot of realism, a lot of seriousness. They still have the humor. The Heenan Gorilla team was more of a comedy duo where you lose a lot of the importance outside of the stuff with Ric Flair. You know, you didn't get a lot of. I mean, Bobby was decent with putting over the importance of stuff here and there, but they were more of working their shtick. Whereas Gorilla and Jesse were more of like a legitimate, you know, commentary, sporting commentary pair.
Exactly, and like for instance, I don't think Bobby would have worked well if he was commentating in this match. I think it would have been he would have had to kind of. I don't think it would have worked for him. And it just is the frosting of just a great dessert. To wrap up a good night of wrestling. And my hats are off to you, Macho, because you are a great champion. And you definitely put this match over, even though you were the one that had to look at the lights. So Hulk Hogan wins his second. It didn't seem like – isn't it weird? It didn't seem like it was only his second.
Yeah, because, I mean, the first round was so long.
Yeah, but Hulk Hogan does win his second World Wrestling Federation Championship on this night in Atlantic City.
Yep, and they, you know – cap off the one-year run. Now, the feud would continue throughout the end of the year, but this was really the main crescendo of that feud. You know, things would, like you said, kind of take a weird slant over the next 7 or 8 months between these two guys. But they would always be at odds, you know, over the next couple of years and always just kind of run into each other here and there. But, you know, Hogan's back on top now. He's done making his movie, so he's back. You know what, actually, we forgot to mention earlier in the show when Jesse gets up to pose, and you know, they used to do that every year. They'd introduce him, he'd get up and do his little poses. Right. And then they showed a commercial for No Holds Barred, and Jesse just goes fucking apeshit, saying that Hogan's invading Hollywood, and that's Jesse's domain, and that Hogan needs to stay out. And he just, it's awesome. Just an awesome promo he cuts.
You almost feel like Jesse was about to come out of retirement.
Yes.
So
I mean, to me, that, you know, Hogan, Savage, Rude, you know, those guys are the MVPs here, but to me, maybe the main MVP was Jesse Ventura on the show. He was just tremendous the whole night through.
Exactly. And it caps off a really good night of wrestling. It's not as long a show. I mean, it is 14 matches, but
it's long.
It doesn't.
I mean, it is long, but I thought it was spaced out well. I thought it was spread out well. The matches are all about the same outside of the main event and the Rooster match. You know, they're all within like that 4 to 10 minute range.
Right.
So, you know, nothing drags on too long. There's a lot of good storyline advancement. You know, some major occurrences, faces winning, heels winning, good balance. And, I think it's a show that maybe gets crapped on a little bit just because of the, you know, the venue and the bloated undercard. But, you know, I think it really is pretty solid. I mean, I think, you know, 4 is fun to watch because of the tournament, but I think overall 5 is a better show, much better show.
Yes, and again, this show countering the Clash of the Champions. Now, quickly, I want to look at that card because I'm curious to see what the rest of that card looked like, other than that match, because the crowd and the payday for that show apparently was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to just take a look at the rest of the card, because last time I remember the card itself is not that great, and we rarely do we slam clashes, because, you know, clashes are great. The Clash of Champions, which is Clash of Champions, is pretty much WCW/NWA's equivalent to Saturday Night's Main Event.
Right.
All right. So Clash of Champions 6, Raging Cajun, April 2nd, 1989. 5,300 at the Superdome.
Ugh.
That's awful. 5,300 for a place that seats like 75,000. Now, they were going to get 75,000 anyway, but I mean, particularly at least get into the 20s. here's your match. Now, you look at some of these matches. They probably weren't that bad. The opener, and this one is close to your heart. The Samoan SWAT team and the Midnight Express matches over 20 minutes. Great Muta against Steve Casey. Junkyard Dog against Butch Reed, which is a continuation of a feud back in the New Orleans days, back in the Mid-South days. Mike Rotundo and Steve Williams against the Road Warriors. Ranger Ross against the Iron Sheik.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I couldn't even fathom. Fortunately, it was only a minute 56. Eddie Gilbert and Rick Steiner, who were the NWA US tag champs. That was Eddie Gilbert's faction. Against Danny Spivey and Kevin Sullivan. Obviously, it's Spivey, but I'm just quoting the Duke. Then there's two dark matches. Sting, who was the TV champion, Rip Morgan. And Luger, who was the U.S. champ, beat Jack Victory.
Oh, God. But obviously, what an awful show.
Yeah, the show is, other than the opener, and obviously the main event is, of course, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, 2 out of 3 falls, 55 minutes and 32 seconds of delicious championship wrestling. Tremendous match. One of my favorites of all time. So top to bottom, even though maybe the main event might be a notch better than Hogan Savage, overall, WrestleMania 5 is just a better show, clearly. And that would be it. That's the last time, before the Monday Night Wars, 6 years later, would NWA try to do anything like this to WWF or vice versa.
Right.
Because it was just – at this point, it wasn't even making any sense anymore. Just so much space in a calendar. Just do separate shows. It's stupid to keep doing this. So there you are, WrestleMania 5. I gave it a B. Justin gave it a B-.
Yeah, I kind of need to reevaluate that. The more I've watched it even since then, and just that main event even, I think I underrated a little bit at the time.
Yeah, I do too. You actually gave it a higher grade than I do. I think I stiffed the match. I may actually change my grade for that match as well.
Yeah, so I think it's probably more like a B. I could maybe be swayed to a B-plus based on nostalgia, but definitely a solid B.
Yeah, exactly. The copy that I have of I had the original tape. But again, as with most of my tapes that I bought before 1995, the oxide wore off and it was unwatchable. The copy I have off of the Legacy box set that came out in 1999, both the WrestleMania wrap, thank God, and the Piper Morton Downey segment was cut out, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, it is odd.
Yeah, that was cut out, and the WrestleMania wrap was cut out, which I'm quite happy about. So just your final thoughts overall on this show, top to bottom.
Yeah, I mean, nostalgia-wise, is definitely one of the best. I love that it caps off that year-long storyline. I love the commentary. I like the, symmetry of WrestleMania 4 to WrestleMania 5 being in the same arena. It really just caps that year of the WWF is wrapped up there, and things would change, over the next few months heading into SummerSlam. SummerSlam, to me, always kind of had a different feel than this show. We get some new guys that pop up and other guys kind of solidifying new characters and whatnot. So to me, this is kind of the end of that bridge between the original rock and wrestling era and kind of that, Hasbro era, like we mentioned last show. To me, this is kind of the 1 year bridge period from 4 to 5. So, I could watch the show over and over. I have growing up. I rented it a ton of times. I had it memorized at one point. Much love to WrestleMania 5 for sure.
Yes, I as well. Memorable moments like the nice, Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino gold rug, and the lights that were kind of hanging from the ceiling. They
yes.
Look like Christmas lights. Those just memorable moments. So there you are. I'm about to close the. Do we have anything else that we have to pull out? I don't think we have to pull anything else out. I'm going to close the vault.
And I am going to read some feedback while you do that.
Yes, I'm going to close the vault. We will open it up again next week for definitely one of my favorite shows of all time, and that is, of course, SummerSlam 89.
Yes.
And we'll do that next week. That's one of my favorites of all time. I'm so looking forward to doing that one. But let's listen to our listeners.
Yep, what
do we got?
4 comments here talking about WrestleMania 5, and that's kind of my fault. I didn't really get this thread up in time this morning. I think I could have maybe gotten a few more, but we got our usuals. We got your buddy, Karen Polland.
The Hot Scott.
He has all the Tag Classics version, and this show is edited to hell. All the matches have chunks taken out of them with the exception of the main event. However, even with that, it's still a better show than WrestleMania 4. Warrior Rude is a good match, but I really want to see the full version. The Piper's Pit segment's a good laugh. Obviously, the main event's tremendous, and the build-up really helped make it more epic. This WrestleMania really isn't mentioned when it comes to good WrestleManias, which is surprising. Also, I want to say I really enjoyed your Macho Man tribute podcast. You both did a great job talking about the career of the Macho Man. Keep up the great work. And we thank you, Kieran, and one of our dedicated listeners.
Yes, sir.
Dennis Nunes who was, I believe, the fan who was upset last night when he thought we weren't going to be doing this podcast. So, Dennis, we hope we delivered for you. His comment says, I have the unedited version from the WrestleMania VHS box set released in late 97. It's at or close to 4 hours, and it's an endurance test to sit through the whole thing. It's a good show in parts. The IC title match is good, although I think Warrior should have won here, then dropped, then have Rude win the strap at SummerSlam, then have it dropped back to Warrior at WrestleMania 6. It's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that concept there. I think it could have been interesting. Curious, Dennis, if you can come back and kind of reply here, or maybe even save it for WrestleMania 6, what you see Hogan doing at that show if Warrior was fighting Rude for the IC title. Dennis also says, also a couple of the pointless undercard matches that probably could have been axed, although Vince would fix that in Toronto next year. Hogan Savage is great, well done. Although, again, I would have Savage go over Hogan and have Hogan win it back at SummerSlam, but of course Hogan's inferiority complex would not allow that. Overall, good show, just could have been an hour shorter. And I actually agree, I meant to mention that. You know, I know that they don't want to have the heel leave WrestleMania, but I think Savage was kind of still over enough that it wouldn't have been like a full heel winning.
Right.
I think they really could have had Savage win this and Hogan win it back at SummerSlam, especially seeing what the SummerSlam main event ends up being. I think they could have probably gotten away with doing that and having the chase last, because I think Savage still had some gas in the tank as a top guy.
No doubt about it. Could have probably had like a nice sexy cage match at SummerSlam, you know, something with some teeth, you know, no holds barred, no DQ, you know, something with weapons, brawl, whatever. I would have had no problem. My brother would have probably thrown pretzels at me and said I suck as an Orange Goblin fan, but that's fine. It would have been his WrestleMania, but yeah, that's a good theory. I like that. A little foresight, a little thinking outside the box. I like that. Good job. Well done.
All right. Also, Corey Ferreira checks in. WrestleMania 5 is a decent show. All I remember from the event is Savage Hogan match in an angle, which is still one of the best angles leading into WrestleMania, I guess I'm about to say, and the two put on a good match. The other match I remember is Warrior Rude, who also had a decent build going into the event. Rude carried Warrior to a good match. Warrior always seemed to perform well at Mania. As the next 2 years, he would have classic matches with Hogan and Savage. Overall, I think this is a good show between a 4 and a 6. Or a good show in between 4 and 6. So maybe those two manias. And finally, Jeremy Nichols. WrestleMania 5 has always been one of my favorites. It's a nice stacked card with all three titles on the line. And the title matches range from decent, like Demolition Powers of Pain, to fantastic, Warrior Rude and Mach Hogan. The Brainbuster Strike Force strikes out is a great match. Sticks out is a great match. And Blazer Perfect is freaking awesome if you have the unedited version. The only match I can think of that stinks on this card is Bad News Duggan, and even that is okay with everything else around it. I love they didn't stack the show with celebrities and instead focused on the matches. And I agree with you, Jeremy. I like that as well for this show.
Yeah,
like we said, it's a pretty well-balanced wrestling show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the feedback for this week. You know, you can feel free to bring more WrestleMania 5 feedback. We'll read it on our next review if I didn't get this up earlier enough for those who wanted to talk about this show. Also, thank you for the feedback on the Savage podcast. You know, we enjoyed, we didn't enjoy the circumstances, but we enjoyed talking about him.
Absolutely. We hate having to do anything like that to someone still so young at only 58 years old. And incidentally, while we're talking about it briefly, while we were recording that, we had Raw on, and the video package for him was amazing.
Yes.
So as much as I want to bitch and moan about this company sometimes, they do the right thing when they have to. So I will give them that. And
we will be bitching and moaning about them next week when we return to our headline show. We'll talk a little bit about Over the Limit and a few other things going on, as well as playoff and baseball stuff going on. And maybe we'll have Andrew Reach on that night. We'll see where the if the finals are set before, which they should be probably. Dallas clinched tonight. Yes. So they're headed on to the finals. So we will be breaking that down with our man Andrew as well.
Yeah,
so
we got a lot of NBA to talk about. I have a new coach.
That's right.
Officially today, yes. Mike Brown is the new head coach of the Lakers.
So we'll talk about that, and maybe we can do a little bit of draft stuff too. We'll see. We'll set things up with Andrew and go from there. And also, we should be back next week with SummerSlam 89. And also, we will do the final pimping for the Matt Rotella bachelor party next week as well.
Yes, the countdown's official.
Yes.
And I don't remember what Savage's bachelor party was in 91, but I don't know if it'll encapsulate.
They did. They did do it on primetime. I think it was a little weird. But it did go down on primetime. So.
Yes, it did. So, thank you, as always, Mr. Rosero. Mm-hmm. Pleasure, my friend, as always. Do you have something ready?
Oh, yeah, I'm ready to go. So let's go ahead and wrap up for Scott Griscola, the PICs. I am Justin Rosero. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy.
Peace.
Once again, the Hulkster claiming he would get his championship belt back, and he certainly.